is not here.
Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. They never will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
Good morning, this is Fran Lewis. This is MJ Network, in memory of my sister Marcia Joyce, and I am waiting for the author of Pirate Trap to call in. He didn't call in yet, so I will tell you a little bit about it. After finding an incredibly lucrative Spanish treasure in the Keys of North Florida, Black Sam Bellamy decided to leave the pirate life and return to his true love in New England. Before being shipwrecked on the way to retrieve her, he hit his booty with Cholo Chan on Port Essex. And there's a lot more to talk about if the author logs in. And we'll talk about my show in just a moment. I have something on Wednesday, the Machine Murders, and on the 2nd, I have Alex Sykes and The Underhanded, and on the 5th, I don't have anything the rest of that week. The week after, I have Fast Times in the City, and then I have Some Kind of Truth, and I have Knife River. And I'm still waiting for the author to call in. I'm going to email him one more time, and hopefully he'll get here. I don't know if I have his cell phone, but we're going to find out right now. Because this is getting... Oh, there he is. Okay, hold on. We are here. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, I got worried here because we were on the air a couple of minutes already. Okay, so tell us a little bit about Pirate Trap and the Baker Group.
Well, Pirate Trap is the fifth book in my Clay Wolf Port Essex Trap series. And Clay Wolf is a PI who was a former Boston homicide detective, but he returns to his small hometown on the coast of Maine to open up a PI shingle and help take care of his grandpa. Mm. So in Pirate Trap, he is hired to find a long-lost treasure by Black Sam Bellamy. A couple of antique dealers have found a treasure map and an old Bible. And somewhere in Port Essex, to help them look for it, and complications ensue. We have motorcycle gangs and pirates, all sorts of scurvious salvage boat operators and businessmen. So it gets quite complex.
But why does he take it? He jumps at it really fast. And then the purpose of the case and the history behind it is really, I love buried treasures. So that's what got me, is a buried treasure. So how come he takes it? He didn't even think about it. He just took it.
He takes the case to make money.
Yeah.
And because he's intrigued with the buried treasure, Black Sam Bellamy, who shipwrecked in 1717, the real fixture, and for his short-lived career was the wealthiest pirate of all time. And so this buried treasure is some rare fire opals found in Mexico put on the Spanish Armada. And when that sinks in the early 1700s with 13 ships, one is never found. Black Sam Bellamy is going to come across that in what is now Key West and bring them up to Maine and bury them off the coast.
Wow. So tell us more about the history of Black Bellamy, and what do they claim happened to him after finding the opals and more? Because that's basically, I love opals, fire opals. Those are gorgeous. So I don't blame them for wanting them.
Yeah, well, Black Sam Bellamy was in the British Royal Navy in the early 1700s and kind of conscripted out in Wellfleet, Massachusetts. And while there, he fell in love with a young woman named Goody. Is actually mm-hmm. her name was Goody. But the parents did not approve because he didn't really have anything. So he decided to go off and make fortune looking for buried treasure or lost treasure down in the Caribbean, the Spanish Armadas that had sunk. And he's unsuccessful at first, and then he throws in with some pirates, among them Blackbeard, and he rises up through the ranks and gets his own ship and becomes an incredibly wealthy pirate. And as the story goes, he then finds the buried treasure. The treasure in the Keys with the Native Americans who were living there. And he truly did summer in Maine. And they think that it was a little further north of my fictional town in a place called Machiasport. And so it's long been, treasure hunters have long gone there seeking the treasure and never found it. So I just moved it down the coast a little bit to my fictional town of Port Essex and said, this is where it actually is. And so everybody's going to heat up and, you know, start looking for this treasure. And that's, you know, a massive amount of money.
That's a lot of money. And who basically does it belong to? Whoever gets it?
Yeah, the laws get very strange with lost treasure.
Yeah.
So if it's found in, you know, off in the ocean, the main law says that, you know, whoever claims it gets it. But if it's found on somebody's property, then that landowner has a claim on it, even if they're not the ones that found it. So not only do you have to find the treasure, if you want to keep it, you have to make sure you find it in the right place. So that becomes one of the twists and turns of this is, you know, you might have to move it to say that you found it somewhere else.
Well, they were pretty clever about it. So the other character I love is Bailey. Tell us about her and what's her role in this case.
Bailey Baker is actually was the receptionist for Clay Wolf in the very first book, The Wolf Traps. But by the second book, she's become a partner of the firm, and they are very flirtatious throughout the first four books as partners and possibly more.
Mm.
And in this fifth book, those sparks sort of ignite. And Bailey and Clay start getting together as more than just business partners, but lovers as well. And in this particular case, Clay Wolf is hired to find the treasure, where Bailey Baker has been hired to find nefarious information about the husband of a woman in town who the woman believes is cheating on her. So it's a husband gone awry, if you will. And it turns out that this husband is actually a sex doll manufacturer, which adds a whole other twist to it. And as would have, those two cases start to weave together and intertangle so that both Clay Wolf and Bailey Baker's cases come together and become one.
That kind of gets dangerous, doesn't it? Just anybody looking for a treasure, who wants it, and who's going to fight over it. So who is Gina, and why do we not feel very happy when she's around and get like an odd feeling? And then we have Tobias Yates. What about him? I don't trust him either.
Yeah, well, Tobias Yates is, you know, he's the one that is the husband of Gina Yates. And is the wife, Gina, hires Bailey to investigate and see if he's actually cheating. And Bailey discovers that perhaps he's not cheating, but he might have designs on finding this buried treasure for himself and might be working with a salvage boat operator to do such a thing. Well, you know, his business has some sketchiness to it.
Well, I know. Everybody wants it, too. That's the scary part. And if they know you're after it, they're going to try to get you. So we have Tobias Yates and Rose Ryan, and they go out on a boat every day. So Bailey thinks that she could do something, but what happens that they know, they think that she's not who she says she is?
Well, you know, Rose Ryan is, you know, another person that has come looking for the treasure. And the thought mm-hmm. is that Tobias Yates is having an affair with her, but it's more about this search for the buried treasure. And what happens to a certain extent is the allegiances get drawn because Clay Wolf has been hired by one person, Bailey Baker has been hired by another, and it turns out that really it's the search for treasure that's both of them. So which entity they're first allegiant to in this matter. So, you know, I don't want to go too far into
No, don't tell me, no.
Ryan and Tobias Yates, but let's just say it gets very complicated.
I know. It's a good thing I picked it through. It is. So... you had to do research. I mean, seriously, how does Clay attack this case, and what research does he need to verify that if he ever finds it? And then you said there was something about Maine and the laws of hunting and finding treasures. So how does he find out that he has to find it in a specific spot? Because there's an awful lot of people that want these opals that are gorgeous.
Yeah, well, the start of it is that these two antique dealers come across the King's Bible, and in that Bible they find a treasure map with a small key that goes to the treasure map, but things have changed over hundreds of years, so it's not quite clear where that treasure map is located and what the key means, and they have to untangle that. But first, they do verify the story of how that treasure map came to be in there, which is the truth that on Black Sam Bellamy's boat, when he shipwrecked on his way back to get his girlfriend in Wellfleet, Massachusetts, to marry her, now that he's a wealthy pirate and thinks that he can do as he will, he shipwrecks just before getting there, and the ship goes down, and only two people survive. And one of them will hang for being a pirate, but the other is a 15-year-old South American black kid, and so they take pity on him, and instead of him, they sell him into slavery at the time. And the grandfather of John Quincy Adams actually purchases him and allows, and that is all fact, but, you know, where I fictionalize it slightly is the boy is allowed to bring along his Bible, which is a King James Bible. Tucked into that is where this treasure is hidden. So that's kind of the onus of what gets these two antique dealers so excited, but because of the change of times and how the map is not quite clear, they need a local liaison to help them find where exactly this treasure is and track it down. And that's where Clay Wolf comes in.
You know, it could have been millions, billions of stuff. Oh, whoa. So now this gets interesting. You have the bar scenes and we meet Silas and Socrates, and I didn't like either one of them. So how are they involved?
Well, I guess I won't give the real clincher on the fact of what Socrates are, but you know, you have this bartender in the book who's come away, and he sort of befriends Clay Wolf and group and starts chatting with them. And as the book develops, we start to become a little suspicious about his character. Mm. And then we also have another figure out there who is called Socrates, and he's either working for himself or for somebody else, but he's a particularly vicious, cold, and callous human being, you know, takes life, human life very lightly, isn't afraid to dispense of it and do terrible, horrible things. So he's kind of the villain that we're fearing out there.
So poor Tobias winds up in the wrong place, but he won't give up. And like you said, Chow is not a nice person. So why does Paley not believe all that anybody says? She realizes she's not stupid, so she doesn't believe anything. She's more like me. I don't believe anything either, unless you see
it. I think it's kind of the truth of the matter is always, everybody is always lying about something. Nobody tells 100% of the truth, and certainly not when you're, you know, looking at, as you said, millions or tens of millions or even more money. People hold things back. They fudge the truth a little bit. And so, you know, we're going to discover that the woman who has hired Bailey is perhaps fudging the truth, and she has her own design on, you know, the treasure.
She's clever, but they still enlist somebody else after a while. So you could tell that Gina, Gibbon, Danny, Rose, and other people are hiding secrets. So how does he deal with that? Because nobody's straightforward. Not here. Definitely not.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is he has to weave between all of these truths and untruths and find his own way. You know, one particular lead that becomes very helpful is he finds that Abenaki Native American woman who lives in the area that's about 90 years old and is full of stories of oral tradition that have been passed down through the local Abenaki. And so she becomes very helpful to him, kind of locating where the treasure might be. And as he pushes buttons in various places to see the reactions of the different people involved, he's able to come to a understanding of what the actual truth might be.
Now, this is really interesting, because Bailey, I have the book in front of me, but remember, she wants to take a thing on the boat. She wants to trip on the boat with this guy, Tobias. So that's interesting. So tell us about the scene on the boat, how you created it, but then everything doesn't go exactly the way she wanted.
Which scene on the boat? Is it the one where they are out scuba diving and looking for the treasure between the mainland and the island? They uncover a legend that certain sailors on an island just off the coast of Port Essex are actually fishermen, had discovered that the Native Americans were hiding this treasure on the mainland. And so they'd gone in and had at gunpoint taken this treasure from them, and then were making their way back to the island where their fishing village was when a storm came up and shipwrecked them. So both Tobias Yates and Rose Ryan and the antique dealers that Clay is looking for are looking for this treasure, in between, in this 5-mile patch of ocean between the two land masses. And they go scuba diving looking for it, and, you know, some problems ensue. I guess once again, I won't, you know, give you the what occurs and what happens in the end, but that's the setup for the scene anyways.
Well, there was one other character that plays a part in this. That's Westy. How does he come into this with them? And then there's Crystal. Crystal's pretty smart, too.
Well, we'll talk a little bit about Westy first, and then we'll talk about Crystal. Westy is Clay Wolf's buddy from, you know, the third grade on. They grew up in Port Essex together. They were best friends. Clay Wolf was the quarterback, and Westy was the running back on the state football championship team. And then Westy went off to become a SEAL and served in the Middle East for a few terms before returning to Port Essex to become a fisherman. And meanwhile, Clay Wolf had gone off to college and then become a Boston homicide detective before returning. And they come back and they reunite their friendship. But Westy is the tough guy in your corner that you always need when the chips are down, because he's no nonsense. He's strong. He's, you know, well-versed with many different kinds of weapons. And so he's a great one to have in your corner when people descend upon Port Essex looking for hundreds of millions of dollars worth of treasure. And then there's Crystal.
Yeah.
So Crystal is sort of an interesting one. She is a former meth addict who was actually one of, was the client of Clay Wolf in the first book, Wolf Trap, when she hired Clay Wolf to find out who supplied the drugs that ended up killing her grandbaby. And she's now clean and sober and, you know, has given up her drug addiction and gotten past it. She has a, you know, she's very rough around the edges. She likes to curse quite a bit. And after the Wolf Trap, the first book is resolved, for the second book, Clay Wolf has hired Crystal to become the receptionist at their PI firm, as Bailey has moved up to become a partner. So Crystal becomes an integral part of the book. You know, one of the reasons I did that was she was such a crowd favorite that so many of my readers, you know, came back to me and said, boy, that Crystal's great. I love her. So she's become a very important facet of the PI firm and a good friend and of Clay and Bailey and Westy and Murphy and Cloutier. So it's a very strong knit group.
I know, and I like them, and you can't kill anybody off. Lately, I've been reading, I counted, it's frightening. I think I've read a couple of thousand books in the last 10 years, maybe about 12 or 13,000, seriously. And every month I post about 250 reviews, I don't know how, but I do. And some of the authors are killing off some of the main characters, and then I stop reading the book because I get upset. There are certain characters that belong there. And then they'll say, well, people are going to get bored, but not really. You're not going to get bored with Bailey or Crystal, so you can't kill them off. No, not Westy either. So then we get on the boat. And Westy has to stay, doesn't he?
I would think so. But, you know, I hold everything back. I do have 3 different mystery theories going currently, and I do feel like if, you know, nobody ever gets hurt or killed that's a good guy, people are going to stop worrying so much and, you know, won't be on the edge of their seat. So occasionally I might have to kill somebody.
Well, you could put him in the hospital, which is how some of the other ones did. One of the New York Times authors, I won't say who, I got really upset because his main character was engaged to this guy that's an investigator, and he was good. They made a great team. So I said, why did you kill him off? Well, because it got boring. She needed a little whatever. I said, but your fans were upset, and I got really upset because it just sort of ruined the whole thing. Then she met somebody else. It's not the same. Sorry. So we have Bailey and Andre, and they're on the boat, and they're in trouble, right? They're like, and then the guy that's on the boat wants to kill Bailey. That would not be good.
Right. And this is getting further into the book when, you know, the treasure has maybe been located and maybe somebody's trying to steal it. And there's a lot of complications that are presenting themselves. And right at that moment, we get a very good twist, I believe, that kind of illuminates a little bit of what is going on. And so I guess I won't delve too far into that because I don't want to give it away. But that sets up the entire end of the book for what I believe to be a real thrill ride as we boats turn into car chases and motorcycle chases and big ships at the house and boats and again. So it's quite a ending to this book, I believe.
It was very vicious. I got really upset and figured I better not go too close to the book. So I don't want to get slammed either by any of the characters. God.
Yeah.
So we have Gina and Danny, and they sort of go at it also. And I was rooting for Danny because that's my niece's name. And I said, yeah, it is. She's a tough one too. So how do you get them to fight? I crack up because when two tough girl characters fight, you don't know, you root for one or whatever, but how do you create a scene like that? And basically someone's going to get hurt, so that's good.
You know, I've been commended, and I hope that it's true, that even though I am a male, I often have very tough and well-rounded and complex female characters in my book, both protagonists and antagonists. And, that's something that I've worked hard at doing. But, you know, I guess I can turn the question back around on you. And how did you feel like that fight scene went? And was it realistic and powerful? And did it resound with you?
I felt like I was getting hurt. Seriously.
Yeah.
Seriously.
I guess
sometimes, like authors like yourself, you describe the scene in such detail that I could close my eyes and picture the two girls fighting. And then there were times that they just say, oh, they hit each other and this is what happened. And I go, like, so what? I don't care. You get more into it, and that's what happens. And then you don't want to put the book down, which is not good because I get eye strain a lot. And you just sit there and, you're wondering who to root for, but then you don't know until you figure it out. And sometimes the ending is like, you don't know, you don't expect that. That's for sure. So I like that scene.
Yeah,
but
well,
you know,
that's good. That's what
Gina's
we're trying
dangerous.
To do.
Yeah, well, you did. You see, I get, when I sit down and read a book, I read 3 books on Thursday, for real. So for those of you, Dick Belsky has a new series. It's by Dana Perry. He changes his name, and it's a brand-new series with a brand-new character, that's all I'll say. And I read all 3 books because I have to interview him next month for all 3 books. How's that? Good challenge.
Wow.
So,
how much reading was that?
There's about 1,000 pages altogether.
Okay.
And I just sat down on Thursday, and I said, okay, you're going to read all 3. And then I started the new Dagoni book. I got that, too. And then I got another one yesterday, and I go, why me? But can you? So Crystal uncovers information, and how does she help to try to solve this case without saying what she does? Because I really like her. Like I said, you can't kill her off. No way.
Yeah, well, My father is an absolute huge fan of Chrissy, so I always threaten him when he gives me a hard time about something that I'm going to kill Crystal if he's not nicer to me. So, but I don't think I'll actually be allowed to ever do that, so Crystal might be safe.
Tell your father I'm with him.
Crystal uncovers a piece of what's happening and shows up at the right time to save Bailey's, bacon and become integral part of the big climatic scene at the end. So her untangling this does become a key component of the book.
Well, the fact that they're searching for opals, oh, God, they're so gorgeous. Culture, I actually looked up the pictures of those type of opals just to make sure that I had it right. And I looked at them and go, like, I want one too. So Cultia is the journalist. And what does she uncover that helps them also and puts them in a different direction? Because they're going in all sorts of directions, and somebody actually finds it and realizes, uh-oh, I don't have it.
Right. Maria Clodier is another friend of Clay Wolf. She's the editor and really the backbone of the paper in Port Essex. And she knows the town better than anybody else and the history of the town and different things that have happened. So not only is she often a great resource for Clay, he's researching something or needs to know some local piece of information or to find out about a Native American woman that is steeped well in the oral traditions of the Abenaki Mi'kmaq in the area. She becomes very involved in many of his cases because of this, and so the information she gleans is always important and often turns the tides in the favor of Clay. So it becomes very important, once again without saying the key component of what she does discover, trying to keep that quiet a little bit and keep the twists and turns going for the potential readers out there.
Well, people that don't read this are really missing out on an exciting experience because, I didn't know what it was about, and this is really cool. I really liked it. And then we have the unexpected, well, I'm not going to tell them if they find a treasure, but who tries to sabotage them because somebody doesn't want them to have it? That's if there's anything to have.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that I try and cloud it very well as we turn into five or six different entities out there that all could be the worst of the worst or have ulterior motives or purposes. And everybody wants a piece of the treasure, but Some just want it for evil gains, and other want it for good reasons. And some people are willing to play a little more fair, while others are cutthroat and bloodthirsty. And so, without giving anything away, I try and leave it right till that climatic scene to see who really the baddie is and who the good people are.
Well, sometimes it's hard to tell. And sometimes the good people have to do bad things in order to get where they have to go. And before I forget, let me repeat this. Wednesday, the guy that wrote The Machine Murders is going to call. I'm going to call him in Greece and hope it goes through. He invented a machine that can detect killers, and the machine with an AI device helps to kill them. That's the truth. Yes, Adam Sykes will be here with the Underhanded on the 2nd. Dr. Gloria Mitchell will be talking about her Garbage Man series on the 8th. And on the 10th, my reading professor and I, Dr. George Cavuto, and I are going to attack iatrogenics in psychology and how they relate to reading disorders, which is my forte because I'm a reading specialist. So that's just some of what's coming up in April. And let's go on. So the OPALs, basically, who seriously owns them? Who's the person that owns them, if they ever find them? Or doesn't it matter?
Well, again, I won't say where they're eventually found, but if they're found on somebody's personal property, the person that owns that land has title to at least part of them, if not all of them. The laws still get a little vague in that. If they're found on public lands owned by the state, then the state has a claim to that. So if it's a park of some sort where the opals end up being, then the state has claim to them. But if they are found in the ocean off the land, then people can claim those. And as long as that claim is not disputed successfully by anybody else, like, you know, the defendant, Black Sam Bellamy, then the people that find it, claim it, get all of it. So it's a very convoluted law that would probably take years to settle in court if these treasures are ever found, unless somebody just sails off into the sunset with it.
Well, where was it originally, and who originally owned it? Well, nobody. It was just there. How did it get where it went, where it was, or anywhere? How did it get lost?
So in the early 1700s, there's a very famous convoy of Spanish Armada treasure ships, and there were 13 of them that were lost in a storm and sunk somewhere off the coast of, you know, southern United States. Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas, it's difficult to tell exactly where. And they were carrying gold and trinkets that they had found in Mexico and South America, and they were bringing it back to the Spanish crown, and that is all true. What I did was I added a ship to the Armada that nobody knew about because they had discovered in Mexico some very valuable fire opals, which, as you have said, are a very beautiful gemstone. And they're incredibly expensive and worth a lot of money. And this 14th ship was known about because they didn't want anybody to know this lucrative treasure they had aboard. So when the whole Armada is sunk in this storm, nobody really knows to look for this 14th ship. And Black Sam Bellamy just happens to put into the area of Florida now known as Key West. And the local Native American population there is all wearing these fire opals. And he paid to get these fire opals by just giving them trinkets and things that probably weren't worth very much. But then he loads these fire opals onto his ship, along with a lot of other wealth that he has accumulated. And he heads up the coast to his summer port in Maine. And he buries the treasure and the fire opals. But then he takes the rest of the treasure and he's going to go retrieve his love from Wellfleet, Massachusetts, Goody Hallett. And on the way to retrieve her, his ship sinks. And so that's the story, which is, you know, 95% sure, but true. But I weave in a little fictional piece of these 14th ship with fire opals as being really the most valuable part of the treasure.
That's amazing. So if they find it and Clay and his team find it, Are they going to use it for a good purpose, or are they actually going to... Well, I would keep some. What the heck? I would keep some. I mean, after all.
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, they have been promised a very small percentage of the total value of the treasure if they find it. We're working for the Andre and Danny. They didn't have the money to fund a down payment for his investigation, but promised him a small percentage of the proceeds, which would still be a very big sum of money if he does indeed find it. And if it is indeed able to be claimed by these two antique dealers, or it might not, you know, depending on where it's found, it might be owned by the state of Maine or a private property owner. So the dispute would certainly last years, no matter where it is found.
This is so exciting. See, I love this stuff. But it's different. It's not the typical murder mystery where everybody gets killed and who cares after a while. And usually I figure it out before the second chapter. So this is good. It got me going. So, before we end, what is next for Wolf and Baker? And where do you see Bailey and Clay? Any chance of anything good?
You know, I haven't really formulated a plot for my sixth book in that series as of yet. I had toyed with the idea of doing a village. Port Essex would turn out to have some ex-CIA operatives hired there, and that's been stolen from me recently by a little-known author named Seth Garrison, who has done a similar story, so I'm not sure if I can do that one now or if I need to change my idea. But I do also have two other series going. So this summer I have the second one in my historical Brooklyn Fellow mystery, which will be set in 1924, and that comes out in July. And that's the second in that series about a Hungarian CI detective. And then in November, I will have the sixth book in my mainly mystery series, which is set here in Brunswick, Maine. And that one will be called Mainly Mayhem. Like the state.
I hope I get the other ones. And my book is a little different. I'm having trouble getting people to want to read Mirror Image. Of course, it's scary. You know,
yeah.
You sit down and you meet a lot of people in life, and some of those people are really not very nice. So I sat down and wrote down 10 stories about these people and what they did that was wrong. And then they were looking at their face in the mirror while the mirror was replaying what they were doing. And they said, if you don't repent, you will be playing that face in the mirror, and you will be a face in that mirror doing it forever. That's part one. And it's really, I love it. It's great. It teaches people not to do the wrong thing and to, you know, repent. The other part is people that were wrongly accused, people whose voices were silenced, and people who deserve whatever I did to them. So that's one thing. But I'm recreating, and I'm asking everyone if they want to contribute. I'm recreating my MJ magazine because it's 14 years since I lost my sister, and she's the one that inspired me to create this. It's going to have my story about something I've gone through for 10 years, other people's stories, but I want to focus on book reviews and interviews and short stories or anything that anybody wants to contribute. The book, the magazine will be on Amazon, I hope, by June, because they're all on Amazon. There are 14 issues. This is number 15. So if anybody has an interview that they've done or an interview that was done with for them, or they want their book titles and their covers in the magazine, in the book, in the great picks, readers, let me know, because I'd be more than happy to put them in there. And you get a free copy of the book, of the magazine. So
fantastic. I'm very interested, so I'll be in contact with you myself for sure about MJ Magazine.
I would love to, and you could look it up. And MJ Magazine has gotten a lot of publicity. It's 5 stars. But my sister died, she told me, right before. I weigh 102 pounds. I weigh 250. My mom had Alzheimer's, and I was eating myself into oblivion, which was not a good thing. I lost all the weight. And she was my editor, and she's gone for whatever reason, which is not good. So I created the magazine in her memory so that everybody should remember that she's here. And the network, that this radio station is MJ Network in memory of my sister, because she's the one that told me, rather than be a couch potato, write a story, write a book. So I did. I wrote it about growing up in the South Bronx, and I think she was ready to kill me because I wrote the truth about growing with her as a sister. Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was always overweight, and she was a dancer. She danced in Broadway shows, and she even danced with Gregory Hines outside of the theater. So she was something else, and she could sing, and she starred in all the Broadway shows as the lead, and I majored in music, and the professor said, you're a concert violinist, you're a concert pianist, but you can't sing. So when I had to do a program, I brought earplugs for everybody, for real, because it was so bad. So before we end, where could everybody find out more about you and your work?
My website is pretty simple. It's the www.mattcoff.net. So if you remember my name, Matt Coff, you can find maybe my website. And, you know, my email is just as simple, which is matthew-coff@comcast.net. But that can be found on my website. And I'm always, you know, happy to hear from readers, writers, and whoever else may be out there. I'll get back to you in a timely fashion. So, yeah, feel free to reach out to me. And Pirate Trap does come out Wednesday. So technically the pub date is 2 days from now.
Well, I'm going to remember that because it's in my schedule. And I'm pretty sure I posted the review, but I'll repost it again on the 2nd because that's the day I have Adam Sykes. So I'll remember. Let me put it in my phone, which keeps me busy. I can't believe that, yeah, it says that, and it says pirate. Okay. You know what's fun about this calendar? It reminds me. I don't have to do anything. Don't you remember you have to do this? Don't you remember you have to do that? But I did. But do you do panel shows ever? So thank you so much. I hope everything goes well today.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for having me on. It was great chatting with you, Fran.
It was nice chatting with you, too. And if you want an interview for any of the other books, let me know, and I'll put you in my schedule.
Yeah, I'll line you up. City Gone Askew is out July 31st. I don't have our copies yet, but when I get closer, I'll reach out to you for sure.
Thank you. Everybody, have a great day, and bye.
Thank you. Bye.